So, Hogan, there's an awful lot going on. First of all, Sonny Joy Nelson gave birth to a little boy earlier this week, and she's not with us, and so that's fantastic news.
That's kind of a weak excuse, but whatever.
I mean, you know, if you would think that somebody who was dedicated to the podcast would be answering.
That's right. If she were dedicated to this podcast, no, that's great. Congratulations for her and her husband. That's just wonderful. And
it is wonderful
to have her back.
Little Isaiah. But anyway, the show must go on. We've got a fantastic guest coming up today. We're going to talk about the fourth indictment of President Donald Trump and also the special counsel and the whole situation with Hunter Biden. And it's really going to be a great show because this is the Line Drive Podcast. So let's do that. Let's bring in former acting Attorney General of the United States, Matt Whitaker. Thank you very much for joining us, Matt. I think that you are the first guest we've ever had who has played in the Rose Bowl.
Tim, Hogan, well, it's good to be with you guys. That's a claim to fame, certainly.
It certainly is. Well, let's get right to it because I know your time is valuable and we don't want to waste much of it. So former President Donald J. Trump, for whom all three of us at one time worked, has been indicted for the fourth time, this time in Georgia. What do you make of all this? The structure of this indictment, the charges that are contained in it, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, it's an aggressive prosecution. I think ultimately, as I've been thinking and reading and knowing my experience, this probably gets removed to federal court in Atlanta, but that would be the Northern District. And that's an advantage for two reasons. One, you have a more experienced judge that would preside over that instead of this current judge that has about at most 6 months of experience on the bench. And then you also have a broader jury pool. You're not just pulling out of Fulton County. You have the Northern District, which is certainly Atlanta Metro, but you go up to the Florida, Georgia line. I mean, I'm sorry, the other way, the South Carolina, Georgia. Hogan almost got mad at me, not knowing my geography, and so I think there's some advantage to that. But, you know, this let's talk about the aggressive nature of this RICO prosecution. I mean, essentially, RICO statutes are used against criminal business organizations or criminal enterprises. And so there are usually many involved. They all, you know, get charged with the RICO conspiracy. And then there's a list of predicate offenses and overt acts. I think to me, one of the interesting things, if you read through the overt acts, they're pretty innocuous. Like Mark Meadows asking Scott Perry for the phone number of a couple people, and they're just there's several things that just don't seem to me to be certainly any reason for criminality, nor the basis for this massive conspiracy. The other interesting thing, as I've read and thought about this indictment, is honestly, I don't know what else the president was supposed to do. You know, he had a lawsuit going on in Georgia. It had not been decided. They were, still hearing the arguments, still presenting evidence. And so the lawsuit was alive. Georgia had to certify their electoral slate. The Electoral Count Act has a process for alternate slates. And, I think this is a real criminalization of the political, and essentially throws a flag and makes criminal folks trying to fight to win an election. And it's going to be very interesting where we find that line to be drawn, but if it gets removed to federal court, that will certainly put a more serious tone and tenor, but also a more robust legal review ultimately on any convictions, if they get any.
So just so the audience understands, too, I work with Matt in the White House. He's an overall good dude, by the way.
Overall.
Great golfer. I'm just trying to take other things into account.
Golfer.
I don't know about you, but overall, good. And he's from Iowa, so he's got some relevance in this conversation as relates to what's going on in Iowa, which we'll probably get to later. But on this.
This sounds like the Hogan seal of approval, but I'm not sure.
Well, it's close. So Matt, do you feel as though this indictment compared to others that are clearly overreaches and things like that, you're talking about going after someone for phone calls, which is not new to Donald Trump, obviously, but you mentioned Meadows, text messages, et cetera. questioning the outcome of election, which Democrats have done in this country for decades. I mean, 2016, if you didn't, it was your patriotic duty to question the outcome of the election. If you didn't, you were somehow a Russian cat's paw and a stooge Vladimir Putin. Is two questions. One is, how much of an overreach do you feel like this indictment appears to be, if at all? And then two is, have we broken the glass here? Meaning, when is it going to happen that Republican prosecutors across this country just start going after Democrat office holders for doing the exact same thing, for questioning elections, et cetera? So it's a two-part question that really the first part has nothing to do with the second part per se, but overall, how do you feel about the indictment first, then we'll go to the second.
Yeah, well, let me take exception first with what you said about me being a great golfer. I think that belittles the game. And it,
I said good.
Insults a lot of people that actually are much, much better than me. I certainly know that you start a golf round on the first tee typically, unless you're in a shotgun. And so that's about as far as I go on being a great golfer. But that being said, you know, I think there's now a line of cases. And I think the second Jack Smith indictment regarding January 6th sort of started this trend where you have an aggressive extension of what the law was intended. You know, in the Jack Smith January 6th case, which is based in DC, you see the use of Sarbanes-Oxley prohibitions in criminal statutes, which was passed after Enron to deal with, you know, businesses committing financial fraud. And then you also have a construction era 1870s statute that was used to go after the Ku Klux Klan in the South as they were wreaking havoc during Reconstruction. And so, you know, that I think this case is obviously is being a RICO statute, which is intended to go after gangs and, you know, really kind of the Costa Nostra and those types of criminal organizations that, you know, make crime a business. You know, they're using that statute now to try to assemble that in this nature. And so I think, you know, it's hard for me to relatively put these together. I think that it's time will tell, but it just seems to me, in my experience as a prosecutor, you know, I've said before that the path to justice is well-worn. I mean, typically these statutes prohibit certain activities and actions and you prosecute people when they violate the law. You know, I think in these two most recent indictments, and certainly an argument can be made for all four, is that, you know, we're in a brave new world. If you look at the Alvin Bragg, the very first indictment up in Manhattan, you have somehow taking misdemeanors, falsification of business records, and shoehorning that into a felony because of some expired statute of limitations has run on the election disclosures. And so I kind of scratch my head on that one as well. But this is why we have appeals courts and why we have Supreme Court. And I think all of these cases are going to find their way there ultimately. And after your first question, Hogan, I'm sorry.
But no, Alvin Bragg seems like a long time ago now, doesn't it?
I know. It really does. How concerned are you about the venue in all of these cases? Like, I mean...
Well, I mean, obviously,
that's against him in a big way here.
Yeah, the Manhattan jury is gonna be tough. We've heard those stats on the voter registration. And typically, it's most juries are pulled not just from registered voters, but they've expanded it to like essentially the phone book. You know, anybody that resides, in the particular district. So in Manhattan, in that case, I think the Florida jury is certainly going to be the most sympathetic to the president, at least fair. And again, remember, the Constitution entitles him to a jury of his peers, not his enemies. So, you know, that's going to be an interesting a small footnote in the history of all of this. I think D.C. is an impossible jury pool. I mean, you saw what they did with the special counsel Durham's cases and how they, you know, those cases were clear violations of law and they just, you know, jury nullified them. And then I think, you know, if it stays in Fulton County, that, you know, those registrations are also difficult, that, you know, that would be a difficult jurisdiction. I think it'll ultimately end up in the Northern District of Georgia in the federal courts, and that's probably a fairly even fair jury pool.
You know, there's a, you know, there's two separate questions here that everybody's been talking about in the media. The first one is obviously the political one, and it's pretty obvious from all the polling that that we do polling at where I work at National Public Affairs and in South Carolina in particular, it shows that, like everywhere else, it's helping Trump in his path to the Republican nomination. But the legal question is a separate one, and you're just touching on it there with talking about the venues and what kind of juries might be constructed from those venues. And even if these indictments and all of the charges contained in them are overreach and an abuse of prosecutorial power, even if all that is true, the charges still exist, whether anyone thinks that they're crap or not. And so that being the case and looking ahead to juries that may be potentially hostile to the former president, what sort of legal jeopardy do you think he truly is in?
Oh, geez. I mean, Tim, that's a million-dollar question. That's a tough question. You know, obviously, nobody wants to be charged with a crime. I think that's the fact that he's still, you know, fighting for the nomination and the presidency is a testament to just his, you know, character and personality. But that being said, you know, I think, you know, ultimately, these most like, you know, I think ultimately will go to trial by and large. And I don't know how they're going to turn out. I don't know when they're going to go. That's going to matter. There's just going to be a lot between now and whenever these go to trial, and certainly a lot of election is going to be come and go. And it's hard for me to predict. You know, typically the prosecutor controls when to charge a crime, but the defendant ultimately on when it's tried has a lot of control. And certainly if the Trump team wants, I think they'll be able to move these and slide these beyond, you know, the election in 24.
Okay, so the second question I had before that we didn't quite get to was, should Republican DAs kind of start
determined
doing
determined to come back to that, Ogun?
Yeah, he's like, boy, he spent too much time in the press corps when he was a reporter.
I want to go back to that because it seems
if only Joe Biden had these kind of tough and
I'm just saying,
give
like
guy a break, Hogan.
Doesn't it go to expose this the ridiculous nature of these? If we just start doing these all over the country, it kind of shows people how stupid it is.
No, you know, actually, I mean? I think that we need to talk about this because the desire for retribution by folks on the right is going to be strong, and there's going to be a desire to get for, you know, an eye for an eye. And as someone that has spent, you know, over 7 years in the criminal justice system at DOJ, you know, I can tell you that once we get to that point, the whole system's going to fall apart. You know, I said it when Alvin Bragg indicted, and, you know, when there was talk of this Georgia case, this is end of the republic types of things. These are the kind of things that ultimately, you know, the system we built is, you know, I hope it's equipped. I hope, you know, our jury system and our laws and our courts can withstand something this polarizing and this political. But I'm not sure our founding fathers ever contemplated this. You know, we've had some pretty outrageous things happen. You know, I think there's also, for example, on January 6th, I mean, there's a double jeopardy question. You know, Trump was impeached for that. So is that, you know, can they get another bite at the apple? Can he be criminally charged once he's been impeached? We've never faced that issue, obviously. And so, you know, I think these are some of the issues of first impression that we're just going to have to go through and see, you know, because, you know, like it's been said, it takes 218 people to impeach somebody in the House. It also takes five Supreme Court justices to say what the law is. So, I, you know, to some extent, I don't know. I'm used to, like I said, the well-worn path of justice. Typically, there are a lot of cases that you can look up and say, this is how these typically turn out. This is a brand new, never before seen thing.
Another one of these things that's never before seen. Now, everybody's one of the questions is the idea of if he becomes president again, can he pardon himself? And on the federal things, it seems clear to everybody that, yeah, he could pardon himself on federal charges. But what about things that are in state court? There's divided opinion on that. I see a lot of folks say, no, he can't do that because federal obviously is different from state. But then I saw a guy like Mark Levin say, no, I disagree because of the supremacy clause and the federal laws being supreme. He could pardon himself on state charges. Do you have any thoughts on those?
Well, the great one is great for a reason. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to quibble with him. Like I said before, these are issues of first impression. Certainly the Constitution provides for the impeachment power. It's very broad. It just says that power is vested in the president. And, we'll have to see. And with separation of powers as it is, I'm not sure the Supreme Court can necessarily say that either. I mean, this gets into very esoteric legal land pretty quickly.
Right.
And this is another reason why I think you're going to see a real push. And Mark Meadows has already filed, and I think Rudy Giuliani has too, to remove the Georgia case to federal court, because then obviously that would be available for sure to be pardoned.
Okay. So one thing is interesting, and then I want to ask you about Iowa too, but I find it fascinating that, you know, a lot of things that Donald Trump was using as the defense when you're talking about Georgia and what he was trying to look into as far as election integrity, et cetera. A lot of those cases across the country are thrown out for standing, which is a fancy way of saying you don't have the right to bring this because you weren't harmed by whatever the thing is. I do find it fascinating that in order to defend himself, he's going to have to enter into evidence a lot of things that never saw the light of day from before. And we'll kind of, there'll be an almost perilous relitigation of a lot of things that were accused of doing and not doing in the 2020 cycle. And I know you probably don't want to comment on that. I just find it interesting to me that that's something that after all this time and all those cases that got thrown out, now may be the time we actually have a conversation about some problems. And this, by the way, YouTube or Apple, this isn't about overturning anything. No one's saying that. I'm just saying it's just really interesting to see that if they can prove some instances of fraud, not widespread, just any fraud. I mean, how much fraud is okay? What's gonna end up happening in that particular case? But I digress.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Hogan, first of all, I mean, I would love to hire you as my press and comms person if I ever need somebody. Sure. But
I can do that.
The second thing along those lines, I think that we need to know is that, you know, especially in the Jack Smith January 6th case, you do have an issue of what Donald Trump believed. And did he have to reasonably believe that, or did he just believe it? And, you know, he's an individual that gets to have his own, knowledge. And so, you know, and what was the basis for that belief? So I think you will see, to your point, I think you will see some of that evidence come into place. You'll see all the affidavits that were, you know, filed by real people that said they saw things. And so I just, you know, it's going to be very interesting how far that goes, for sure.
Now, Tim, can we talk Iowa for a minute?
Whatever you like. Yeah. Iowa football or just Iowa?
He's from Iowa. He just got.
Yeah, I know. He's a triple Hawkeye, aren't you? Aren't
he just
you a triple?
Got back from Iowa.
Oh, like, aren't you a triple Hawkeye?
Yeah, I have 3 degrees from the University of Iowa.
University of Iowa. All right. So, tell us, you were there. Were you there for the fair?
I went to the fair on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. I don't want to admit that on Saturday night I went to the New Kids on the Block concert, so we won't even talk about that. Well, Sunday night I did go to Eric Church, which was a great show. And then on Monday, Senator Eric Schmidt came up and we flipped pork chops and voted in the straw poll and just kind of had a great time in Iowa at the fair. On Saturday, there was this guy named, what was his name? I think it was Donald Trump was there.
And so were you there when the plane was circling?
Yes, it was pretty epic. Wild. I was actually at the pork tent. DeSantis was flipping pork chops, and all of a sudden, you know, there goes Trump Force One flying right over the fairgrounds. It was a boss move. They also had this plane pulling a banner that just said "Be likable, Ron" with an exclamation point. I think that was an homage to the Jeb.
And the thing when DeSantis was speaking and Trump Force One was circling the fairgrounds, I tweeted that if you wrote this scene in a movie about a presidential campaign, the director would cut it because it's not believable. Like, this is too far-fetched.
Yeah.
That's insane.
That's but kind of ahead. A lot of some of the things we deal with from time to time in Trump world. But they, that all seems to fit together and make sense in the context.
Well, tell me how this fair or this campaign is kind of going in Iowa, how this fair compared to previous ones. Look, I've been there for Huckabee, Santorum, et cetera. I've been there many times. How does it feel? What's different about this election, this caucus versus the rest as you see it?
That's actually a very insightful question. I think there's some things that we need to understand. Caucus campaigns used to be able to build to a crescendo on caucus day. And typically that involved identifying your supporters and just making sure they were there that night. And if they weren't registered to vote or were registered as an independent or a Democrat, you could fix that all at the caucus. And so you told them to get there early and make sure that they were properly registered as a Republican, because it's a party function. Remember, it's not a right. state or a Secretary of State function. It's a party function. It's a straw poll, it's a preference poll. This time, the legislature didn't want any kind of Project Chaos to happen. And so they said that you have to be registered with a party 2 months before the caucuses in order to caucus. And so that requires these campaigns not only to identify their supporters. And remember, 2 months in a primary, there's a lot of shifting. And so you could identify somebody you think is yours, and all of a sudden you register them and they show up on, you know, great 2 months point. Later and vote for somebody else. That's a risk. But, you know, it's to some extent, this is going to be a very, detailed or also you're going to have to understand who your people actually are, who the real people are, not just some like, oh, we're going to get, you know, 27%. Is what our model shows. You're going to have to actually know what, you know, if 160,000 or 200,000 people vote, who are your, you know, 40,000 people? What are their names? Where do they live? Where they, where, you know, you're going to, it's going to be a, it's a massive endeavor, really, at the end of the day.
Good. We're running out of time here. I want to talk very briefly about Hunter and the special counsel that's been appointed. David Weiss, do you know David Weiss?
So I met him several times. He was a U.S. attorney when I was at Justice in the Trump administration.
What do you make of this? A lot of Republicans, as soon as that happened, said, well, this is a sham. This is just a way for the Biden administration to keep control of an investigation that they really don't want to pursue. So they put their guy in there. This is the guy who engineered the sweetheart plea deal with Hunter in the first place that, of course, blew up. Right. What's your reaction to Weiss as the special counsel?
Tim, I completely agree with what you just said. I also want to just add, you know, Merrick Garland's playing chess here, and he knows what the ultimate goal is of this game that he's playing, and that is to minimize the exposure of Hunter Biden. And so, there are moves that are made. The judge, for example, rejecting the plea agreement. And so that responded with him appointing a special counsel. There was nothing that changed. You know, I called for a special counsel years ago. In this case, you know, this should have had a special counsel. It certainly shouldn't be David Weiss, who, to your point, gave a deal that no one could point to another example where somebody got this kind of deal.
Right.
Only the president's son could have gotten this deal. And so, you know, Hunter's in serious trouble. You know, he's going to have a felony gun charge filed against him soon. He's going to have at least two tax charges that could be felonies. And don't forget the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the Foreign Agent Registration Act that still kind of hang out there. And we learned at the plea hearing were still being investigated.
But if the FARA violation actually occurs here and they actually go after him there, does this ever eventually get to Joe Biden in any way, any significant way?
Well, I mean, we have a prima facie case, which is a fancy way to say we have all the pieces and parts of a case for a, for a bribery. I mean, this is clearly... we know that the folks at Burisma wanted this prosecutor gone. We know that they were paying Hunter Biden, who is the son of the vice president. We know that the vice president went to Ukraine and hung, you know, U.S. loan guarantees to $1 billion over Ukraine's head in order to fire this prosecutor. And so to me, I mean, that is, you know, that's a prima facie case. I mean, now we just have to look at the motivations and, you know, in the last couple of weeks, we see where a guy that was, you know, understood how this all fit together and understood Hunter's business dealings was on the plane to Ukraine on that trip with Joe Biden. So I, to me, it's somebody having the courage. I think the other problem is, you know, the statute of limitations is probably run on that. I mean, that trip happened in 2015, and this most statute of limitations, including the FCPA, would have run 5 years later. So we're probably talking 2020 that was gone. And, you know, of course, I mean, there's a reason they impeached President Trump for this, you know, for this phone call, for the perfect call, right? Because it was a good way to completely wag the dog and make everybody look the other way and think black was white.
Amazing. Well, we look forward to tracing all these things, and we really appreciate your insight and your time here tonight. Matt Whitaker, the former acting Attorney General of the United States of America, thank you very much for being here.
Congratulations.
Really appreciate you, Matt. Thanks so much.
Great insight. And this has been the Line Drive Podcast.